We're back.
How's it going?
It's going okay. How are you?
Okay.
Football did not come home yesterday.
I have no idea what happened.
England lost. Oh, okay. To Italy.
Is Italy the final boss?
Yeah. Italy won, and they started engraving that trophy so quick before I could even like get my wits about me. And then I walked home sadly in my Fred Perry polo.
Yeah.
But it's okay. The World Cup is next year. I've gained kind of an appreciation for soccer that I didn't have.
Oh wait, this prior. Wasn't the World Cup.
I called it the World Cup on the last pod, but it's the Euro Cup.
Okay. So it's like the primaries for the World Cup or what?
I think it's just a different thing.
Okay.
Soccer stuff. But I feel like I've turned a corner and I've started to enjoy kind of masochistically how tedious it is.
Yeah.
And then it's like edging, the moments of actually something happening are so much more satisfying because it's
unlike baseball where they stand around for 3.5 hours with their dicks in their hands on a field. There is some like action that leads you to believe something will happen and something can happen at any moment.
You don't want to take too many smoke breaks.
What was
breaks.
The score? Like 1-0?
It was 1-1 and then it went to penalties. Okay. And then sad. But okay, but fine. Not really my, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not English. I'm just
yeah.
An Anglophile.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm looking for my jewel. You went to Boston.
We can pause. Yeah, I went to Boston and I went to Rhode Island. Baby's first road trip. It was nice. I saw a lot of cool billboards about Jesus, Freemasons. Mm-hmm.
Very
abortion.
Cool. I always think it's weird when people name their kid Mason because it's such a white trash name.
Yeah.
But it has this kind of high society aspiration to it or something. It's such a weird name.
I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, I always thought it was weird that Kourtney Kardashian named her kid Mason because she's Armenian and her baby daddy's Jewish. It's like a weird kind of like pseudo WASP thing. But then, fun fact, my sister got to the bottom of it. Kardashian means son of the stonemason.
Oh.
Yeah.
So very fitting name then.
Yeah. So that's probably why he has this like stupid pseudo-elite name.
Mason. Baron, another great elite name.
Yeah.
For a big towering boy.
Hulk of a boy, yeah.
6'7" Baron Trump.
Is that confirmed?
Yeah. Well, that's what I read in the Daily Mail. Yeah. And he's only 14?
He's 16, I think, now.
How?
I don't know.
I swear, just the other day he was...
He ages exponentially.
He's getting bigger and older. Yeah. He has like Marfan syndrome
called. Cremagoli or whatever.
he is looking pubescent. Mm-hmm. He had some acne in those pics of him like towering over his mom. With a Louis Vuitton bag.
It happens.
Of course.
Do you think he'll be able to preserve his golden boy jeans? Because the other Trump sons are really inbred looking. They look like McPoyles or peacocks.
They look awful. Maybe. Maybe Melania will kind of counteract some of that pear-shaped Trumpian physique.
I don't think it's possible. I think like the Trump family are the only like blonde blue-eyed people with like a recessive gene package that like somehow became dominant. Like they own everybody they interbreed with.
Ivanka is pretty attractive.
She's the most attractive one.
Yeah.
But she also has like a chin implant.
Well, yeah, she's had some procedures.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Bless you.
Excuse me. Oh my God. We'll edit that out.
Achoo.
Sorry. Bless you, mother. That's how Baron says it. What else is on the docket?
I don't even know. If I was brain dead before, I'm even more brain dead now.
That's good. That's what the fans like
I'm
to
like
hear.
On that Joe Biden tip.
Rapid decay.
Yeah, seriously.
Cat Person.
Cat Person. Remember that story? News, yeah.
Back in the news.
What did you think of Cat Person? The story.
We talked about it on the pod, and I don't remember what my hot take was, but I remember liking it.
Yeah.
But then I revisited it, and it seemed shittier than I remember.
Huh. Interesting. I should have revisited it, but
you probably have. I mean, it's very mundane, but at the time I remember finding it like impactful and mm-hmm. successful as like a short story,
right?
And I think feel like we had like a good convo about it, and I thought specifically the description of like the sex in the story was interesting.
Yeah, like fairly accurate and naturalistic. Yeah, I remember that. I asked because I also remember being pleasantly surprised by autofiction style short story published in The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
At the height of Me Too.
Well, that's why it was so viral. Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe revisiting it after this. So this Slate article came out. That's why people are talking mm-hmm. about Cat Person again. That was written by a woman named Alexis Nowicki.
Uh-huh.
Nowicki.
Alexis Virgil, Texas.
And the headline was something to the effect of like, I thought Cat Person was based on my life, and then it turned out it was.
Yeah.
And she described a relationship she had with a man in his 30s when she was in college, who uh-huh. when she read Cat Person was very reminiscent of this real person that she knew, who she calls Charles under uh-huh. a pseudonym.
It's called Robert in the story.
Yeah, in the story Robert, in the essay Charles, but his real name unknown and doesn't really matter. And she had a hunch that this story was somehow inspired, because that Kristen Rapinian's story was inspired somehow by her relationship mm-hmm. with this man, Charles. And then after his death, a friend of his confirmed that he did in fact know Kristen Rapinian.
And had like a sexual encounter with her, right? That was the idea? Like they had some kind of
romantic or sexual, encounter. And then he told her that he was seeing someone, a younger woman, this uh-huh. Alexis girl, and then she took the creative liberty to sort of fictionalize her projection of what their mm-hmm. relationship seemed like to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of talk sort of about the ethical dimensions of drawing from life and fictionalizing in this way, which I felt was pretty overblown. Obviously you're well within your rights as like a writer to do something like that.
Yeah, a literal creative writer
to
cherry pick from your personal experience or your secondhand experience. That's like literally what writers do.
Yeah, especially because she didn't actually know this girl. And what she found kind of painful and challenging, Alexis, was uh-huh. the way that Robert/Charles was described in Cat Person. She sort of portrayed him in a highly unflattering light as like a predatory, misogynistic character.
Okay. Well, I have a bone to pick with Alexis's perception of Rapinian's portrayal, because I think that she deliberately and willfully doesn't fully get it. But also this feels like, interestingly enough, Alexis is also a writer. Like she alludes to having an editor and I think possibly an agent or something like that. Uh-huh. So she's trying to make it big as a writer, and this just feels like her kind of coming for the throne or whatever. Or not even that, but I think like she was probably miffed because she also had like three subject matters she could write about. All three of them failed.
One was having an older boyfriend. Yeah, and then Rapinian swooped it up.
She like
and
beat her to the punch.
Told her truth for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would preface this by saying that writers, like fiction writers, are notoriously horrible, nefarious people who treat other people in their lives as caricatures and mock and humiliate them, but that's what makes them great in part.
Yeah.
That's the essence of art.
That's why you should never fuck a writer.
Have you ever fucked a writer?
Yeah.
Like a fiction writer, an author, not like a journalist.
Yeah, I had a, well, I had a playwright. I had a boyfriend who was a playwright.
Nice.
And I'm sure I inspired him.
I was his muse.
And I was his muse. And no, I mean, yeah, I probably slept with a handful of writers, and I hope no short story ever surfaces about a girl named Glosha.
Sasha.
Yeah, so, well, okay. You have a bone to pick with Alexis.
Just a little subtle bone, because her kind of like point that it's a weird article, because you would think that she would, she's fairly moderate and measured. Like, she doesn't try to cancel Rupinian like outright. She doesn't really confirm.
No, she confronts her in an email, and Rupinian responded
in like a canned, like
quasi apologetically
kind of way.
Yeah. Sort of. Yeah. Which she didn't need to do, and probably was sweet of her to acknowledge, I guess.
Or she was also nervous that there might be some sort of like cancel campaign or legal action down
because
the pipeline.
The real cat person wasn't a misogynist. He was a normal guy.
A nice, normal, sensitive guy. But here's the quote. About half of Cat Person is a sex scene. In it, Rupinian depicts the type of bad sex that's easy for readers to relate to. Not explicitly harmful or abusive, but towing the line of consent and leaving Margot feeling repulsed afterwards. This is where the story diverges completely from my reality. Aside from the fact that, like Margot, it was my first time not having to sneak around in suburban basements to hook up, the latter half of Cat Person does not mirror my relationship with Charles. In Rupinian's story, Margot laughs when Robert asks if she's had sex before. The first time Charles and I hooked up, he was surprised when I told him I never had. In Cat Person, Margot is turned off by Robert's aggression and embarrassed by his vulnerability. Rupinian spends a good portion of the story describing just how disgusting of a person he is. Of course, I know nothing about how Charles was with other women. I can only speak for myself. With me, at least, he was careful, patient, and gentle. It was the first time someone asked if they could kiss me instead of just doing that. To me, that's like a very confused misrepresentation or like account of things, because she's like willfully and deliberately confusing the kind of artistic devices Rupinian uses in the story with Rupinian's own opinion of Charles, which we don't know. Mm. This is Margot's opinion as the protagonist, and I think she's also the narrator, right?
Right.
I think what Rupinian did really well, kind of elegantly and subtly, was that she created this image of Charles as the kind of perception of a young woman, a young and inexperienced woman who was simultaneously flattered and repulsed by him, and was maybe exaggerating certain repulsive characteristics of his in her own mind to kind of rationalize the relationship or her break with it or whatever.
Yeah,
like, you see what I'm saying?
No, it's yeah, definitely.
It's like,
I mean, he is, the portrayal of Robert in the story is very uncharitable.
Yeah,
but as you said, it is from the perspective of the young female narrator.
Yeah, who's confused and doesn't quite know what she wants, and is enchanted by her own
allure
effect. Yeah, the effect that she has on men. Is very much like a creature of like the Me Too moment. And I think that that was very impressive of Rupinian, because she basically kind of creates or imagines the mindset of like a young contemporary woman. And that's where, which is easy for her to do as a young contemporary female writer, much like Welbeck, right? Imagines these exaggerated male protagonists who are repulsive and misogynistic and have like a very like uncharitable view of the women they date.
Yeah, and it probably wouldn't have been a very compelling story if it reflected Alexis's more tepid and mundane reality of having a fairly normal relationship with a person who is within a kind of a normal spectrum of human decency and attractiveness. That's not gonna hit the that's probably why they didn't publish her story in the New Yorker.
Exactly. But I think, but again, I thought her exaggeration was like a very, again, like very elegant and subtle and not too on the nose or too moralistic. Like the beauty of Cat Power, which a lot of people missed, is that she doesn't really moralize in either degree.
You said Cat Power.
Cat Person, sorry. I love Cat Power. Fun fact.
The beauty of Cat Power. Yeah. I would give it a reread.
Okay.
I think, and maybe because I read it after reading Alexis's piece, it did feel more uncharitable.
Okay.
And maybe my initial impression of it should have rang more true, but...
Well, I mean, the other thing to remember is that, like, these are fictionalized personas where certain details may have been lifted from Charles and Alexis's lives, but they're sort of, like, descriptive, naturalistic details. They don't really necessarily mean anything.
Yeah, that's not really what the story is about.
Yeah.
And the story is now being like adapted into a film.
Yeah.
And so then it'll take on an even kind of...
A new life.
New life. And that's sort of what's interesting about it and why the story is so enduring, I think. Yeah. Did you notice which she talks about after finding out that... Charles has died.
Oh yeah, spoiler.
she said, this is like in reference to, I think, maybe their last like correspondence, because she never asked him if he knew Rapinian, weirdly, and she didn't find out until after he died from a friend of his.
And she says that maybe she never asked because she didn't want to know, like, you know,
it's a lot of I wouldn't get so bent out of shape about a little story personally. But she said, I'd posted on Instagram that I was collecting money for Black Lives Matter related orgs. Something aggressive, fist emoji, not milquetoast neoliberal, he labeled his Venmo to me. I texted him the receipt.
Yeah.
Definitely Red Scare listener.
Charles.
Yeah.
Robert. R.I.P.
Milquetoast neoliberal?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
That's the real smoking gun of this whole thing.
That he's stealing from us.
Cat Person...
Rapinian is actually stealing from us because she knows the guy who...
Yeah.
Let's confront her on the pod.
The guy from Cat Person is a average male Red Scare listener, it turns out. Which you really see, as no surprise.
I'm so humble and so self-abnegating that it would never, ever occur to me to think that... this weird guy that this weird story was modeled on.
Listen to your podcast. Listen to
our podcast.
That's the real story.
Yeah, that's the real scoop.
I was intrigued and entertained by Alexis's essay.
Yeah.
I obviously, one could like call into question why she felt the need to sort of set the record straight on the reality of this fictional story.
There's a movie being made about it. Yeah.
You could, make the case that she's sort of like cynically trying to maybe boost her own writing career. But I thought the essay was decently written and kind of interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I was intrigued also and entertained. But also because I really did enjoy Cat Person. It was like one of the few works of art of the Me Too era that I can remember being actually good and complicated.
Yeah.
But not just because Rapinian is half Armenian.
Well, you know, Nicholas Braun is going to play the guy in the movie.
Who's Nicholas Braun?
He's on Succession. His cousin Greg.
I
was just palling around with him in Italy.
He's gonna play Charles / Robert.
Nice. Yeah, and I think he's gonna do a good job, honestly.
That'll be great. He can say milquetoast neoliberal in a Netflix series.
I don't know if it's a Netflix movie. Major, but I think it's like a studio film. But I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah,
I'm biased, obviously.
But. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm excited.
I guess we could review it.
I think, like, I don't think...
Cat Person podcast for all your Cat Person related needs. Yeah.
I don't think, like, and I don't think it's so conscious or cynical necessarily even. And you know, stories like these are like a dime a dozen by now. So this one isn't particularly like horrible or egregious, you know?
Yeah. No. I actually have a charitable view of her motivations, I think. And part of what's interesting about it is that it does feel like it closes the autofiction kind of loop that then self-perpetuates. You know, you could see how this could be done with like a number of like autofiction pieces that have kind of like a companion personal essay.
Yeah, reality,
That's all that's doing a essayistic autofiction take on that then, you know.
Yeah.
Did you read the Sally Rooney?
I did.
Story? What'd you think of that?
Yeah.
No cat person, huh?
No cat person. I'm not really a Sally Rooney fan.
I am, I guess. Well, I'm unclear if it was a short story or like an excerpt from a new book of hers. It seems like the latter, maybe, because it wasn't a very contained narrative. But I enjoy reading her, and I think I enjoy autofiction generally just because I'm like lonely, to be honest. So there's something, I don't know, easy and kind of comforting about reading about people looking at their phones in a internalized voice that kind of like mirrors one's own.
And there's some sort of like psychic linkage that occurs when you read about the experiences of similar late 20s.
I should play that girl in the Sally Rooney movie because I'm really good at looking at my phone.
Yeah, just like flicking through. Yeah,
so like I'm a shoo-in for that part.
But yeah, it's like, you know, when you look at like when you read these accounts of like late 20s to late 30s millennials kind of stumbling through life as like permanent renters or whatever, stumbling through like romantic episodes, that sort of thing, there's like some kind of psychic link of recognition that occurs that makes the process very familiar and enjoyable. I don't think like Sally Rooney is an atrociously bad writer or anything like that. She does have a certain like faculty.
I think she's a good writer. I actually think she's very adaptable because she is kind of a cinematic writer.
Yeah.
And the way that she describes people's internal thought processes and kind of the omniscient narrator who's kind of like noting all these little personal details that people are doing, I think is very cinematic kind of.
Yeah, it is. It does. But this is my problem with Sally Rooney. I find her to be overly calculated and cynical as a writer. She knows what she's doing, which is getting these kind of stacking future adaptations, which, you know, again, I don't blame her for managing her own career or whatever, having ambition, anything like that. That's like fine. But like the content
at
itself,
this point, anything that everything is up for IP. Because there's
how do you mean?
In intellectual property, like any story or book of note, basically, will be adapted.
Yeah, totally. But
it's
guess
like a law.
I mean, listen, I'm coming at this from like, you know, a boomer perspective, in the sense that like I like Bernhard and Jelinek, and I like very cruel writing that is cruel, not because the writers themselves are cruel or unempathetic or whatever, but because they are describing the cruel reality of, you know, existing in the world. And I think like Sally Rooney is, she's very smart because she sees how kind of sad and atomized everybody is and lonely. Like this story was about like a very lonely young woman who's like striving to make a connection with a childhood friend. But I think like there's something I can't quite articulate about her
while looking at her ex-boyfriend's SoundCloud.
But it's very, I mean, to me, I guess it's very kind of like unworthy A, of description, and B, like pandering to the tastes of people like us. Like it's too easy.
Yeah.
And so like that for me is kind of, you know, frustrating.
Definitely. Well, it's unambitious.
Yeah.
And it's not particularly creative.
Yeah, well, it's ambitious in the wrong way. Like you're right, it is like unambitious on an artistic level, but it's ambitious on a professional level.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's what I mean.
And that's
what I mean creatively, like autofiction has like a kind of end of history feeling to it, where it's like nothing new. It really gets generated. Everything is just sort of descriptions of atomization, basically. Yeah. And that's kind of the best that we can muster as a culture.
Yeah, that's...
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, and that there's... I don't think that there are... Like, I don't think that new ideas are impossible. I think that they're absolutely possible, and we're going to see new ideas, like, emerge in the next 5-10 years or whatever, but...
I'm working on a short story about me reading the essay about that person.
Just like scrolling and through your phone on New York Times, and they hit you with the, you've reached your limit of 10 articles.
She sighed, pressing the login button, striving to remember her New York Times login. Fake, she types in fake news 69, gaining access
Lolita,
to the rest of the article.
91. Yeah, there's something, I don't know, there, I think Sally Rooney, like, when I read her and when I read Rupanian, I notice, like, you can feel the distance between the fiction and the reality. Like, you can feel their, like, their little engines turning in their heads. And it's funny that Rupanian talks about how she had to bat off, like, all these questions and allegations about kind of the nature of her private life and how it overlapped with her fiction, because it's very clear that there's a wide chasm there and that she's very smart and doesn't necessarily throw her life into her work in that way.
Though I'm sure the cat person story was kind of like a amalgam of experiences that she projected and actually did have. And then,
but I almost think that, like,
the Robert character at least does seem to be, at least descriptively, which again is not what the story is about, so it shouldn't really matter, but you know, if we believe Alexis's account, she seems like certain things about his character she did kind of exploit and describe.
But I think, like, she, I think, like, you know, it's inevitable that little kind of particles from your real life will enter any art you make. Like, all fiction is autofiction fundamentally, in the sense that, like, all polemic stems from, like, personal subjectivity. Like, so I think even, like, having that kind of category is murky. And also, like, you know, I mean, you know me, I'm also not really particularly a fan of, like, feminine female confessional writing in general, because I think, like, it's not even like the old argument that, like, you know, people will say, like, well, this is uninteresting and unworthy of description, as I just said moments earlier, but that it's, there's something actually, there's something, like, very kind of, again, indulgent and pandering about being so, like, hyper aware, like Sally Rooney and her constant references to, like, meta references to discourses people our age are having about, like, Marxism and communism and this sort of thing.
Yeah. But I think that's all very true to her experience, because she's Irish. Dublin, So she kind of is out of, you know, is in this milieu. And I actually found it in that story specifically because the girl, I guess she works in publishing.
Yeah, she works at, like, a boutique literary magazine as an editor.
The references to, like, Marxism and stuff sort of caught me a little off guard. Because it didn't seem entirely plausible for her to actually be inhabiting that same milieu that Sally Rooney clearly does, you know? Like,
well, Dublin is small.
Dublin is small.
And they all know each other.
Right.
Kind of like the people at the U of Michigan creative writing department.
All those MFAs are just...
All those horny,
sucking and fucking
MFAs,
and writing stories about it.
But yeah, what was I going to say? But yeah, that's, I think that's what I remember having this conversation with Angela Nagel, who's also, like, not a fan of Sally Rooney, that, like, all of the little breadcrumbs that she leaves about kind of Marxism, communism, socialism, whatever, it makes, it kind of also creates a continuity between her fiction and her persona. And for a long time, Sally Rooney rode this kind of post, like, Chapo, post-Bernie wave of popular socialism. And people were like, oh, she's a Marxist and a socialist and also a fiction writer. And that, I always thought, also her, like, branding was always somewhat kind of cynical in my mind.
And a bit on the nose.
Yeah, and I think now she's doubling down a little bit on her kind of implicit, ironic critique of Marxism, making these people look a little bit foolish and like out of their element, because that whole political platform or vanguard or whatever has been kind of discredited.
Right. If she was a truly like vigilant kind of convicted Marxist, she would be writing about like factory workers and stuff and not like people texting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, but.
But like she, there's something, yeah, about like her kind of conspicuous branding that has always bugged me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like she, it seems that she, again, she's a very diligent, fastidious writer. And I like her more than a lot of writers who just pepper the writing with like hyper research details because they can't develop plot or characters.
Right.
Sally Rooney doesn't really need plot or characters like those.
No.
She functions in kind of like abstractions or archetypes or whatever. But yeah, I think in spite of clearly being like committed to a certain kind of level of storytelling or whatever, I would say that she probably puts kind of her reputation before her art in a way. At least that's how it comes off, yeah. Which always freaks me out because that's the wrong way to go.
But I
it.
Think it's hard when you become kind of like a young literary star.
Yeah, that's true. That's also it's not entirely her fault because, you know, it's like I remember having this conversation like a million times in 2014, 2015 when like post-internet art was a really big deal about how like if you peak at like whatever, 23, 25.
Yeah.
That's actually not such a good thing.
Right.
Because it's very hard to follow up any...
Exactly. And it's much easier to like break the mold when you're not celebrated and rewarded for creating the mold.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, that's true.
But anyway.
Shall we next on the docket?
What's next on the docket? Vice article about hot girls eating... tin fish.
Oh yeah.
From which I felt kind of conspicuously absent a little bit.
Yeah, I thought that was a little bit of Dasha erasure.
I kind of put tin fish on the map.
That Riga gold.
I've been sardine posting for a decade probably.
Yeah.
I put socialism, tinned fish. Both on the map, and I get no credit for it.
Tinned fish is actually just the food of socialism.
Also true.
Like Soviet socialism.
Yeah.
Also, did you notice that everybody quoted in this article was somehow associated with nylon? I was like, does Vice own nylon or the other way around or what? Like, every single person was like nylon-affiliated.
Yeah. Well, I almost thought that it was PR.
Yeah.
Like, a PR puff piece for that, like, tinned fishwife
woman fishwife, totally.
And then they had to like source kind of quotes from it felt like a publicist wrote it, where they were like sourcing quotes from people who they already had relationships with in media. And that's why it feels that way. And the piece itself doesn't really have much of a thesis.
It's literally like anything can be hot girl food. Yeah, hot girl says it is.
Hot girl food can really be anything, according to Twitter. Oatmeal, coffee and a croissant, buttered toast, the Crunchwrap Supreme, blah, blah, blah. Hot girl food seems to suggest an appreciation for eating, but not in a complicated way or an unconventional way or a way that's particularly concerned with wellness. It's more Alice and Roman than it is Gwyneth Paltrow.
It's like hot girl food is literally flavorless, low calorie food. Or food that you can only eat in small portions. It's literally deferred enjoyment food.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And it's funny because this woman,
hot
Caroline...
Hot girl food is liquid.
Yeah, it's just like congealed.
It's juice.
Yeah, it's on the spectrum of just oatmeal nothing or the too oil solid. That they put the fish in.
Right.
Anyway, there's this woman, Caroline Goldfarb, who has some like probably like undesigned neolib reboot canned fish company called Fishwife. And she told Nylon that it's just like Vice quoting Nylon, that tinned fish is the ultimate hot girl food. And this, her stated reason is that it's high in protein, but it's obviously also because it's like cheap and low cal.
Well, the omega-3s as well, not just the protein.
Yeah,
it's got those healthy fats, healthy oils.
Yeah.
It's
mercury.
Low in mercury. Yeah. I mean, true, I guess.
Yeah.
But I would disagree, I guess, with the premise that it's like that hot girl, that sardines and hot girl food have like a kind of like unfussiness about it.
Yeah.
I think what's hot about eating sardines is that it takes a kind of like confidence in your dietary choices, you know, because they, until recently, until these puff pieces started getting published, were pretty maligned.
Sardines.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah.
Especially in America.
Yeah.
I have a very specific traumatic childhood memory of being cruelly mocked by
like in school.
By bringing a Sprat sandwich to school, really excited for lunchtime, and then getting like cruelly mocked by like a bunch of first graders and throwing my sardines in the trash.
That's so sad. All Russian immigrants have this memory of like their mom like making a gross like lunch for them that American kids don't understand because they like ate square pizza or whatever. Being like, and like coveting, like being like, mom, can you buy me like cotton candy or like a hot dog on the boardwalk? I like was looking at this like Russian meme page and the mom being like,
growing up Russian,
yeah
or Slavic youth,
growing up Russian. And the mom was like, нет, у нас колбаса.
Паштет.
Yeah. And you always want like the American.
Oh yeah. I coveted Lunchables.
Yeah.
Which in retrospect such trash. Not hot girl horrible, food. Yeah.
I think we should somebody would make big bucks if they came up with like a Dimes Deli like Servos version of Lunchables.
Like a bento box, like kind of thing.
Yeah, like a tapas.
Yeah,
plate,
that's a good
like
idea.
That. Yeah,
probably with some sardines. I mean, the margins on sardines are fantastic with this new craze.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. So sardines are like the perfect food for women who, again, want the most amount of nutrients for the lowest price with the lowest calories. That's like all it is at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And then there's probably like some ethnic component, like a Euro Slavic component.
Yeah, a kind of exoticism of I mean, anchovies also.
Yeah, I love anchovies.
They're my favorite. It's my favorite food.
Canned fish.
Canned fish. And I think I do deserve a little. Was I not on this PR PR mailing list?
No,
Someone float by, like maybe Dasha?
It was really weird. And also, didn't that girl weigh in who literally interviewed you for like Layla or something?
Which is, I mean, so, they quoted her. I don't even think she weighed in, but they quoted her a tweet of hers about sardines.
Yeah, it is really, you know, there's a Dasha-shaped hole in the article.
I have to pee. Sorry.
Oh, God.
You killed
him. No. He came at me.
Oh,
he came at me, though.
Sucks.
Okay. I'm debating.
Oh my God, we're back.
Leaving this like
I mean, maybe if you can hear my screams, that could be fun for them.
Yeah.
I just had a terrifying encounter with a cockroach in Anna's bathroom. I don't have roaches in my apartment, surprisingly, because I live above two restaurants.
Oh,
and you would think, I mean, not that
they're,
I've
seen, because they don't ever go up there because they're like feeding on the restaurant.
Right,
they never need to make the trip upstairs.
So it's been a while since I've
been besieged by vermin. Yeah. In the past, so yeah.
Though that's one of my big, one of my major fears.
What?
To have like a, to bear witness to some kind of horrifying infestation.
Oh yeah.
You know, like opening a drawer and it's full of bugs or.
Yeah. A
pretty common fear, but.
I think like this apartment actually is pretty low on the vermin and pests, but since it's gotten really muggy and hot, they like migrate upward.
Yeah.
And I was like literally breastfeeding the other day and this like giant like water bug style cockroach, like the one we just saw in the bathroom, flew like buzzed past my head. And I was like, what is that? Like a hummingbird? It was like so huge. God. And it like landed on the baby's bassinet. I felt like such a bad mother. I was just like, I can't believe I can't provide a better roach for you.
Small price to pay to live in the, in New York City
on the Lower East Side.
I feel like it's on me, but yeah. It's not. Anyway, what are we talking about? Tinned fish, I don't know. Tapas.
You like peel back the tin and it's just a bunch of cockroaches in oil. Virgin olive oil. I will say actually they try to bill sardines as like some kind of like effortless, sensuous food, but you have to have good motor skills if you're eating those things because it's very hard to peel back.
It can be. Yeah. Some are easier than others.
Yeah.
The Riga Golds, obviously,
are made of like aluminum.
Superlative brand. And those are kind of easy to open.
Yeah.
But you can't eat a whole, you can't slam a whole tin of those. You get heartburn. So then you have to transport them into Tupperware or.
Mm-hmm. Put it on a cracker.
Remember when I got into vegan caviar?
Yeah. I remember we had a little taste testing, like Coke and Pepsi thing. And it was like not immediately, like the vegan caviar, you could tell it wasn't the real deal, but it was very close.
But yeah, especially if you're drunk.
Yeah.
Shoveling that down, it's basically just as good.
I remember when somebody was mad at you because you posted a picture of yourself eating caviar and they were like, this rich elitist bitch. And I was like, no, you don't understand. It's like dirt cheap in Brighton Beach.
Yeah, it was like roe. It was like red caviar.
Yeah.
On like dry bread. Call me like a class traitor.
Yeah, like that German bread with the chick riding a bike on the cover or whatever.
On the cover.
Anyway, so basically anything can be hot girl food as long as
the portions are small and yeah, and it's a little kinky or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, it's also like it's the perfect food for people who kind of want the perks of having an eating disorder but lack the discipline to fully commit.
Mm-hmm. The perks. Being skinny.
Yeah.
But not too skinny.
Yeah.
I feel so policed by the eating disorder stuff. I feel like I can't even speak freely.
Yeah.
Because I'm always being accused of being pro-Anna, even though I'm not.
I never understood like what the big deal was, but I don't understand why everybody is so triggered and sensitive about like eating disorders, which are such like a sliver.
Yeah.
Of the population that it barely counts.
Especially in the extremes where they result in, you know,
fatality
or hospitalization. It's like, I think most women have some form of disordered eating and just being honest about that. That's what the article really should have been about. Yeah. But I guess that's not how you sell the Fishwife branded tins.
I mean, yeah, most women just like, yeah, they probably like restrict on some level, like shuffle their food around on their plate.
Or you know,
like,
what's definitely not hot girl food?
What's that?
Like a huge sandwich.
Yeah. Like a triple decker. Yeah.
I find women
do
not enjoy like a big, big sandwich.
Well, cause it's too much commitment.
Yeah.
Women and like to like graze non-committally.
Exactly.
And they hate, I noticed that
nuts and berries.
Like a fucked up thing I noticed is that, you know, since I've had the baby, every time I see one of my girlfriends or my female relatives, it's like, why don't you eat and I'll hold the baby? And it's like a game of hot potato because a baby is a perfect excuse to like, you know, shuffle food around your plate and never eat.
Interesting. Yeah.
It's like such a thing. And I'm just like, no, let me hold him. He's my son.
You eat. Yeah. You have a nice big bite.
And there have been several occasions where, like, I went to, like, a dinner with a kid and, like, one of my girlfriends heaped a ton of food on my plate.
Interesting. And
I was just like, I see you, bitch. I see what you're trying to do.
Well, you need it. You got to get the cows for your breast milk to replenish.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like, for the next year, I have a great life because I can eat whatever the fuck I want. And it just like goes in one end and out the other. It's
like, out your tits. Yeah, yeah.
It's like super chill. I actually probably think like eating canned fish is not the best thing to do because there's probably like high levels of mercury.
No, Anna, you keep spreading this misinformation.
Is it not true?
Canned fish. No.
It's not. Okay.
Very low compared to like sushi and stuff. Like actually.
Okay, cool.
Tinned fish has very low levels of mercury.
Yeah.
But I'm not a medical professional, so.
It's actually a great therapy for COVID. Just crack open that box.
That's how I've staved it off for. Did you hear about this gay cold?
No, I have no idea what that is.
I think it's just COVID.
Okay.
But
it's like a hybrid AIDS and COVID that you need PrEP and ivermectin for.
It's, I think it happened while I was abroad, but a lot of people in our extended friend group fell ill with something they called gay cold.
Okay.
That apparently was transmitted at Pride or something. That's why they call it that. But, I think it really is probably just some weird variant of COVID that's annoying, but
the Delta variant,
who knows?
Highly infectious, but less fatal.
Yeah. Something like that. But I feel pretty good. Could I have some wine?
Oh yeah, totally.
Just a little splash.
Canned fish and wine. Great combo. Yeah. But I think, I think all of this food is like basically just like low effort food. Also, it's beyond the eating disorder thing. It's like for young women who no longer single. Know how to take care of themselves and are single and live like, yeah, shambolic lives and never wash their hair or whatever.
Well, yeah, you're not going to like, which is, yeah.
Yeah.
Archetypally hot girl style behavior.
Yeah.
A hot girl doesn't like prepare an elaborate meal. You know,
exactly. You
just because they have better things to do.
A slice of bread,
exactly.
Smear some hummus on it. Do a line of cocaine.
Choke down some fucking kale just to keep going one more day. I've been going to Joe and the Juice a lot.
That's like a Jamba Juice type situation, but like
it's like a juicery that has these little paninis that for some reason are one of the few things I can stomach these days.
Yeah,
and there's one by my apartment. A lot of great restaurants over there. So I've been
like Sweet Green.
I find myself going to
Chipotle,
Joe and the Juice a lot, which I used to feel averse to, and something switched, and now I'm there every day.
Wait, you felt averse to?
I just thought the branding
chain
was gross, and it's very similar to like Dr. Smooth, which I also find a little alienating. Yeah. Like the menu is very similar, and the branding, though Joe and the Juice is like. It's kind of like urban, I guess. It's the branding is very weird and bad.
Yeah, it's like a guy.
It's like a guy.
Silhouette of a guy.
A guy with like maybe a fedora, but maybe that's, I'm misremembering.
Yeah.
But it feels like, like a silhouette
it's
of
very
the
2009, the branding. Yeah,
the namesake Joe.
Yeah. Joe
and
Rogan's
the
juice
bar. And that's how you... stay alive one more day.
are smoothies hot girl food?
For sure. Acai bowls, smoothies.
Yeah, that kind of shit.
Any
yeah.
broth. Broth is major.
Broth, iced coffee.
Spaghetti.
Yeah.
Actually, like it's hot to be like a model, like slurping down like some spaghetti for a photo op. And then
I love those like Instagram Explorer images of like a really hot girl with an even tan and like Leticia Costa hair wearing like some sort of bustier top, you know, and
with
sucking
like a big
down,
plate of pasta.
Yeah, sucking down like one strand of pasta.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, you cooked this entire like bolognese for this particular photo.
You're usually, well, okay, hot girl food definitely at a restaurant.
Yeah.
If you're branching out of like your tinned fishes mm-hmm. and kind of like easy to prepare.
Yeah.
I don't think it's hot to make spaghetti. I think it's hot to like go to
eat spaghetti at a, it's literally not figuratively hot to make spaghetti.
Yeah.
It's sticky and annoying. It's actually quite easy though.
It's never as good as I finally had a really good bowl of spaghetti in Rome my last night. Believe the hype, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not really. I've never been a fan of pasta per se.
Really?
Yeah. I like pasta as a vehicle for like the sauces and the other fixins.
That's what it is. Really.
Yeah, I don't like Asian noodles either.
Hmm.
I don't like anything that's like flavorless carbs.
Well, that's why you flavor them.
Yeah. Well, no, I know, but you can just avoid.
You can just eat the sauce.
Yeah. You can just, yeah.
With a spoon, gazpacho style.
Chew and spit.
No, no.
Baby's mouth. Anyway.
Bulimics love spaghetti because it comes up easily. Not that I would know anything about that.
I actually didn't know that.
Anyway.
Yeah. Shall we move on to from hot girl discourse? I'm also like not really a fan of the hot girl
summer, hot girl walk, yeah
I find it to be annoying. Like there's something like simultaneously entitled and needy about it, and it's like a half joke that girls on the internet do, and they're like, haha, I'm just joking, and it's like you kind of mean it, and
yeah,
it's not up to you to decide whether or not you're hot
if like you're being upfront people. About your narcissism and pretending like it's like one big joke, huh?
Yeah,
people will find it less repulsive,
yeah,
and
yeah,
it'll
yeah.
give you like plausible cover for posting photos of yourself, I yeah. guess. Yeah, well, I remember hot girl summer
mm-hmm. that was the Megan Thee Stallion thing.
Yeah,
yeah,
and then since then it's proliferated in all these little ways.
It's like really spiraled out of control into the pages of Nylon and Vice.
Yeah, should we talk about the TikTok dissociative identity disorder community?
Yeah, sure.
Speaking of spreading like wildfire,
the real gay cold
is the personality disorder TikTokers have. TikTok makes me feel 1,000 years old.
Yeah, me too. You've downloaded it.
I've downloaded it. Was okay. First of all, wasn't Trump supposed to ban TikTok? I thought that was one of his promises.
Yeah,
and that just we've just forgot about that's not happening. I guess
totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I've downloaded it. I've like looked. I look at like TikTok compilation Instagram accounts.
Uh-huh. Like
because I'm 30. Leia's?
Like TikTok compilation Instagram account.
Yeah, or like various meme accounts I follow mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll come across a TikTok. We are apparently pretty popular on TikTok. I wouldn't even know how to look into that, but sometimes people send me kind of like Red Scare centric or like Sailor Socialism centric TikToks, and some of them are pretty funny. Some of the stuff on TikTok seems like legitimately very creative and funny, but it makes me feel schizophrenic just looking at it, and like autistic and overstimulated.
Yeah, it like makes me want to transition. Just like no, it's legitimately, you know, I never like, because I'm so old that I can like whereas I can understand kind of an argument sometimes intellectually, I can't really feel it kind of intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this idea, right, that like just the mere fact, the existence of these apps really amplifies people's mental illness.
Right.
And like, I understand that. Like, I understand how that works, but I can't really imagine the process by which, like, I feel like it's a really chicken or the egg thing. Did you have DID before you started the TikTok, or did it did the TikTok inflame kind of a pre-existing tendency within you?
Well, so DID, dissociative identity disorder, basically having like multiple personalities, is a very rare actually like diagnosis to get. But the DID community on TikTok is like proliferating wildly because people use their altars. Mm-hmm. There's all this weird language about it. They like, it gives them an opportunity to showcase kind of their alternate personalities.
Yeah, it sounds which like is you're just clearly doing impressions.
Yeah, which is clearly highly performative and rehearsed.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, I was reading, like, these people call themselves a system, so it'll be like, you know, like 12 or 29 identities living within the body of a single person.
Yeah, meet the Dasha system. Meet the Red Scare system. This is Anna. I'm the reveal is it's this whole podcast is just one person.
It's just one extremely fat woman who sits in a tub.
Meet Anna. I'm 35 years old and reactionary. Meet Dasha. I'm 30 and delusional. This one's racist. This one's...
It's just like a balding man.
Yeah, so these... every kind of TikTok... DID TikTok user comprises a system.
Yeah.
That is... made up of their alternate personalities that they switch into.
Yeah.
Oh God.
I hate being uncompassionate and ununderstanding. And you know, I'm already confused by the gender identity stuff. Like, it's just confusing because I'm like an old hag and it's like over my head. But this is like an infinitely expansible, like matrix or like Punnett square of different identities mixed with different gender, like,
yeah,
they all have also different gender presentations
and ages
and ages, like, yeah, there's like so many variables.
It's just so medically, psychologically not what I understand to have to pertain to the real kind of disorder in any way.
Yeah, and like back in my day we just called it multiple personality disorder. Now it has like a new kind of rebranded name. And it all screams to me just like you were molested as a child. Like, it's clearly,
well, there's definitely a
childhood trauma, molestation trauma.
There's definitely a sickness there.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether or not you're like legitimately dissociating and entering into like another alter or another like state of mind or another little character that you're doing on your TikTok. It's like, even if you're doing that performatively, mm-hmm. under the guise of like mental health awareness,
yeah,
it's still, yeah, there's clearly some early childhood trauma.
Yeah, and I find it very difficult. Like, there was like some quote, there's a quote from one of these girls who has one of these systems talking about,
I tried to watch like a compilation video on YouTube and I found them also just, I couldn't get through like 30 seconds of it. It made me sick.
Yeah, I wonder what, like,
I can't imagine why you would. I mean, I know I sound like I'm 100 years old, but I just, I gotta go to Joe and the Juice. I don't have time to watch all these, all these sick people having outbursts on TikTok.
The fact that these people are so kind of articulate and self-aware about the nature of their disorder seems like a red flag for me too.
You know, it's the same thing with Tourette's. There's a big Tourette's kind of TikTok community, as there is like autistic women showcasing their various like tics.
Yeah.
And whether or not it's authentic doesn't really concern me as much as the behavior itself does.
I guess it's literally there in the name TikTok. It's literally just like an online asylum for people with mental tics. But it's so funny that they're so obsessed with like this concept of like fake claiming, which is claiming you have a certain mental illness or mood disorder for clout, I guess.
Right.
Because you could argue not, and you wouldn't be entirely wrong, that everybody there is sort of faking for clout. Even if they have the diagnosis, many of them are exaggerating for their audience. I mean, there's something perverted about not only normalizing but promoting mental illness.
Yeah,
and it's funny, there was a
right, because it's like celebrating their quirky personality disorder.
Yeah, and it would seem like this would be kind of counter to the clinical recommendations for treating or mitigating these sort of disorders. Here's this professor of clinical psychology that they quoted in the article. I would never want to impose a version of self upon somebody that they don't themselves actually endorse, he says. Just because I've never seen it doesn't make it untrue. And it's like, you know, with shrinks like this, who needs enemies? Like, this is like a licensed professional, trained professional.
Yeah.
And it's funny because they spend basically the entire article portraying him in kind of subtly portraying him as like an oppressive white male expert,
mm-hmm.
which is like exactly what he's not, because he's like a total like cuck and ally.
He's explicitly giving them free reign.
Yeah, because he's like so scared to put his foot down and act as an authority figure. But this, and so then there's this 25-year-old host of something called The Cloud, which is a system of eight that has 52,000 followers. She feels the stance presented by this guy is an outdated one. Formerly, it was very common that the treatment for DID was to progress toward what we call final fusion, where all the identity states become one. She explains, nowadays, a lot of therapists are embracing functional multiplicity,
oh my God,
as either a portion of their treatment process or the final goal. And it's like, you know, well, as long as everybody's making money, like you're making money on your TikTok mm-hmm. system, your shrink is making money on
leading you astray. Yeah.
and it's like, you know, this is like a boon for the psychology industry, which loves like an interminable patient that you can't treat.
Mm-hmm. It's who doesn't want to be treated.
Who doesn't want to be treated, who wants their disorder kind of like creatively managed.
I mean, and this is all also to me just feels like kind of the logical conclusion of the ableism industrial complex, if you want to call it that, where it's like any kind of clinical approach or therapeutic attempt is misconstrued as ableist intervention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And therefore everyone must be given not only free rein to be as like mentally ill as possible, but they are rewarded for it.
Yeah. And yeah, they're basically, because it makes money for everyone. And when in fact these people are all desperately crying out for an authority figure. Yeah. It's a giant cry for help. I mean, it's very like, I saw somebody on Twitter was talking about Eric Frome's Escape from Freedom, which is like a book that I also highly recommend that I read like a very long time ago that I'm going to revisit now, because it was up there with like Lash's Culture of Narcissism and kind of like, you know, articulating my instincts about what was going on in the culture. And, you know, he's right that people primarily spend their entire lives trying to kind of slaw off their responsibility
mm-hmm.
and literally escape from freedom because it's scary. And this is, I mean, this feels like the total like logical conclusion.
Yeah.
Like having multiple identities, some of which are underage, like 10 year olds, you know,
lock them up.
Yeah.
That's seriously. What I say.
But it's like, you know,
if you're on TikTok, you need to be in a sanatorium.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you are effective. Like that's literally what it is. Like TikTok is like the Foucauldian panopticon.
An outsourced mental hospital.
Yeah. But it's crazy because it's also like, this is going to be like a huge, you know, boon for pedophiles on the left who will be like, well, you know, what's so bad about a child having consensual sex with an adult who has an identity that's also a child? Like all of this is so, you know, perverted. And I was thinking, I like wrote down this Paglia quote that I saw on my Paglia quotes,
Instagram
from Sexual Personae, where she talks about mutilation and reduction of the body are ritual ascesis of the overexpanded modern imagination. And this is what all these mental disorders are. They are the kind of overexpanded modern imagination, i.e. your internal monologue, your self-awareness, your self-consciousness run amok. Like they're ultimately solipsistic, you know.
But do you think they're delusional?
Well, yeah, in to the degree that like thinking about yourself so much is delusional.
But in terms of actually, I think,
are you asking me like if you think these people have real kind of dissociative identity episodes where they believe that they're somebody else. I mean, it could, I don't know. I'm not.
My instinct is hell no. I think they fully have a cognitive understanding of the fact that they are like lying and performing.
Yeah, and my instinct.
And they've created like a rigid culture where you can't. Where any sort of critique of that is ableist.
Yeah, I mean,
how the most retarded people don't want you to call to say the R word anymore.
I mean, you know? I think like yeah.
And now they're coming for like stupid and idiot and wait, stuff really? Too. They want to like, I mean, you know,
low IQ.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think like
the frontier of like ableism, social justice on Twitter.
Yeah,
seems to want to eradicate any kind of like. Reference to not just cognitive impairment but like low intelligence, low IQ.
Yeah, and they want to eradicate any mention of kind of what they would call natural hierarchies so that even more perverted and coercive and unofficial and unnatural hierarchies can emerge, you know, like
mm-hmm.
But
if my kid was on TikTok making,
I would slap that phone out of his hand. Like,
what the fuck is, if my parents found me like, making little disassociative identity disorder TikToks, they would have whooped my ass.
Yeah, totally.
And thrown my phone in the fucking ocean where it belongs.
Well, it's like, you know, again, who am I to say whether or not people genuinely have certain disorders? I mean, they're definitely mentally ill in some way.
For sure.
But I don't know. I mean, it's like the autistic girls on TikTok thing. It's like, yeah, I'm sure there are autistic to the degree that a lot, you know, most people,
most Zoomers are like a little on the spectrum from machine learning.
But are they kind of enhancing, dramatizing their autism for attention? Sure. Is that a horrible, blasphemous sin? I don't know. Again, I'm very charitable about this because they're young people. They literally don't know any other way. It's like people who've been obese their whole lives. They don't know any. They
I don't think it's a sin. I just think that there is like a cognitive dissonance between their purported diagnosis and their behavior.
Yeah, and I think
like it's not very autistic to kind of perform your tics for attention.
Right. Well, because the old view of mental illness was that because it was something that was like so stigmatized, people were ashamed of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean,
re-stigmatize it.
Yeah. No, but there's something really, really freaky about normalizing mental illness in the name of giving people like a forum or a community, because it's actually counterproductive to like helping them and healing them.
Of course. Yeah.
It requires like all of these TikTok communities require the ongoing existence of like mental illness.
I wonder if it'll kind of turn a corner where you'll see people self-diagnosing and kind of proudly associating with like Munchausen. Like I'm faking all my diseases, but that's because I have this like umbrella disease called Munchausen.
Yeah, totally.
And like, don't stigmatize my my mental disorder because it's integral to my identity and thus valid.
Yeah, I mean, I think like nothing. I can totally see that happening. I think there's like, you know, nothing.
Someone get Jamila on the phone.
Yeah, she's like the queen. Yeah, and it's funny because it's I saw also like this other tweet from this guy where he was like, well, you know, being misgendered sucks, but being correctly gendered and still knowing that people experience me as a man sucks even more.
What?
And I was just like, what do you want? Like, what more do you want? Like, if people, you know, you can't, this person is asking that people literally police their own inner thoughts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he has like an intuition that people kind of,
he wants to be absolved from
she
or I'm confused, but they want to be sort of absolved of the burden of identity. And this is probably also what's happening with these dissociated TikTokers, mm-hmm. is like they've taken individualism to such an extreme that they've like fragmented into multiple mm-hmm. individuals, sincerely or not.
Yeah.
Because the burden of being like one identity or one person
is too much. Yeah.
I think unbearable in some way.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think the idea of having a fixed identity is something that they crave, but that they are profoundly afraid of committing to, because to have a fixed identity implies to be responsible and accountable, and mm-hmm. that's what they can't bear. You know, it feels like Peter Pan syndrome. And they, whenever they're asked to have any sort of responsibility, they react in panic and stress. I mean, this is basically
anxiety
disorder.
Anxiety disorder.
This is all just giant anxiety disorder. And I was thinking about this in terms of like the Paglia quote and like the kind of trans thing, the rise of like transgenderism, and you know, setting aside the question of like gender or any of that, being transgender requires a lot of, you know, ritualism. In a way, because not only are you forever kind of on a hormonal regimen, and mm-hmm. not only are you dealing with like the, you know, your post-surgical wounds, but like as far as like male to female or transgender people are concerned, they have to constantly maintain their like neo vaginas. That literally structures your day, you mm-hmm. know. That's another, it creates kind of like a routine, a schedule for you to follow mm-hmm. in the absence of one. Like, I definitely think that's an element of it too.
Well, I mean, I think that speaks also to how you're seeing more of a rise in like non-binary identity yeah. rather than yeah. like, I think fewer people are willing to commit to like an actual like transgender identity yes. than are willing to like co-opt some kind of ambiguous queer yeah. non-binary expression yeah. where like wherein anything and everything is kind of valid.
My question is like, how much, like what role does the internet, particularly social media, play in the rise of like,
I mean, massive.
Yeah, which is scary
because it is of a linguistic like discursive medium that is primarily about language.
Yeah, and a mimetic medium.
Yeah.
And it's crazy that there's like literally a cottage industry of like therapists who are more than happy to encourage DID TikTokers to let their freak flag fly.
Yeah.
Like at what cost?
Yeah.
And you have to think about like, who are these people?
I mean, clinical psychology has been fraught from the get-go. So yeah. it really comes as no surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, not like there was ever like a standard.
No, that's true.
And it's all it's ever done was like reinforce dominant ideology.
Yeah.
And it used
totally.
To, dominant ideology used to be more about kind of like stigma.
Yeah.
And
well, it was,
the norm, reinforcing kind of like a homogenous culture and norm. And now that norm has become, yeah, this like neoliberal free for all.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of old image of clinical psychology, right, was molding, sculpting the individual to conform to society.
Mm-hmm.
And it dealt with neurotic and repressive disorders.
Right.
And
if you have, yeah, anxiety, we will attempt to eradicate it so that you can be a more productive member of society.
Yeah. And now I think clinical psychology, again, I think I said this actually in the last episode or something, it encourages people to self-actualize, i.e. it encourages, it wants society to bend to the subjectivity of the individual, where, mm-hmm. which you can see how that can go wrong.
TikTok.
Yeah. but it creates a really scary problem, because what you have, like, what emerges as this TikTok article illustrates, is these people who have like very subjective criteria for what counts as mental illness or childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And if you attempt to question them or dissent from their opinion, you are a monster. Because again, these their violence. Claims are fundamentally unfalsifiable. They're unprovable.
Right. Damn.
Yeah. It's like our usual beat.
The docket. Yeah. The docket runneth over with. I mean, it's very hard for me to tell because I do feel so old.
Mm-hmm.
And don't actually feel like I have a real understanding of like the TikTok landscape or culture. Yeah. So I can only really understand it by proxy through these kind of like think pieces, trend reports exactly, about kind yeah. of what's going on. But my suspicion is that, yeah, just younger, there's something more nuanced even happening that escapes me because I'm not a Zoomer.
Yeah, probably. Again, I mean, it's like what I was saying. I can intellectually understand TikTok, mm-hmm. but I can't intuitively understand it, which is a big problem.
Right.
Because you have no lived experience with it.
And I never will.
What's also interesting is that all of these people seem to have spouses, like they're married.
Very interesting.
And I was confused for a moment. I was like, are their spouses also like
an alternate personality?
And then I was like, oh no, they're referring to like real people. And I was thinking like, oh, these people are crazy. Imagine how crazy their spouses are. Like, who would sign up to be married to
a system?
A system of 29 people, some of which are 10-year-olds, like
to help them make their TikTok content.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and I think this is going to like go both ways. On one hand, it's going to like normalize pedophilia, but on the other hand, it's going to open people up to
well say more about pedophilia. The pedophilia angle I'm missing, because you're an adult pretending to be,
yeah, if you're like a system and three of your alters are like under the age of 10 or something,
right
you can make the claim
that, and you seem to be able to switch into them kind yeah. of at their whims.
Yeah, you could be like, well, why shouldn't my 10-year-old alter know the joys of
that's a little, I don't know, but maybe you're right.
On the flip side, I think like it'll, in this like whole like fake claiming economy, I think it'll open people up to allegations of pedophilia, like cancel campaigns, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a lot of, I don't know, all of this stuff really freaks me out, because I think that it's like the mode seems to be like infantilizing adults and responsibilizing children.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I think also on, I don't know, last episode or two episodes ago, all of the major debates that we're having on the internet about children,
right,
are scary because they are led by people who are completely indifferent to the well-being of children.
Right.
Even though they don't have
any stake.
Yeah, they have no stake. Like their view, their image of the future is a fundamentally perverted one, because it doesn't involve future generations, because everything is so solipsistic for them.
It's giving me a really, really bad feeling.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest. As does TikTok.
Yeah. But well, the other thing is like TikTok.
I guess that's just aging, is when you start experiencing the fear.
Yeah, you become like an even bigger libtard than you were before, and start like railing against like imaginary foes or whatever. But isn't TikTok also like a Chinese-owned company?
I think so. I think that's why Trump was going to ban it.
Yeah, so it's like the Chinese also now have like a blooming database of like American mental illness. What was this, the percentage that they gave, like 48% of adults under 29
using TikTok? Couldn't be me.
Yeah, that's like,
yeah, I mean, clearly one could make the case that it was created by China to undermine the fabric of our society. But maybe that's a little extreme. I don't know. I think there are aspects of it that are worth examining, and like would give one a an interesting impression of a kind of zeitgeist, and mm-hmm. in that way it's also reflecting back like the pathologies of our time mm-hmm. to us, and then that way it's just, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But I don't know,
I just noticed your very cool LL Bean socks.
Thank you. Yeah. They're not really summery, but
yeah,
I haven't,
I love LL Bean.
Me too.
That's another thing that probably
ages us. Classic American heritage brand. I'll just stick to my LL Bean yeah. catalogs.
None of those TikTokers are wearing LL Bean.
God. Anyway, do you have any closing remarks?
No, I guess, I don't yeah. think so.
I guess I would just reiterate my initial point, which is that there's definitely a sickness. I just don't know if it conforms to traditional diagnostics
parameters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think all of this, again, like all of this obsession, like fixation on mental illness does have like an authentic, genuine core in that people are literally issuing a collective cry for help.
Right.
And there's no
and a,
one.
Yeah. And a cry for discipline.
Yeah. Well, I mean that, yeah.
They're begging to be stomped down by a strong man. Good God. All right.
anyway.
See, and we'll see you in hell.